This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Punks and skunks to this non-conformist episode of Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com.
No, dude, do that again.
Dot com.
No, dude, drop the fucking accent, do it again, and then we can cut to the bit.
Dot com.
Dot com?
Dot com. Welcome, everybody. I am super excited that we are back, and it is now February, because we are starting a whole new theme, and that theme is, are you ready for this? Are you ready? Start. I wish we had a drum roll going right now. Really get the band warmed up so that we can let you know that February is Gals Who Rock!
Yeah, I am super excited about this. This is actually, oddly enough, this is another clearinghouse month, which I managed to put together in a theme that is so tightly constructed, you would think that I had to search for it. But all four movies we're talking about this month are movies I've mentioned in previous episodes that we need to talk about. And first up, we're talking about a movie I've been trying to get on the show since season one. I remember when you first moved into the steakhouse, I was talking to you about this movie, and you're like, yeah, I keep hearing about it. I need to check it out. And it's been put off and put off and put off. And finally, we are fucking here.
And speaking of season one and previous episodes, which was a really nice segue, you can find season one and all those previous episodes on iTunes, as well as on Blog Talk Radio's network for us. You can also find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And what is Junk Food Cinema? Well, it's the weekly cult and exploitation film cast, so good, it just has to be fattening, hosted by myself, Brian Salisbury, and my co-host. He is a novelist, he is a screenwriter, he's a lieutenant of Megaforce, he's the Sid to my Vicious, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
And we're going to kick off Gals Who Rock, or the opening act, if you will, with 1982's, ladies and gentlemen, The Fabulous Staines.
Corinne Burns, what are you going to do?
My name is not Corinne Burns.
Oh, what is it?
It's third degree burn. I'm the lead singer and manager for the Staines.
It has become clear to several thousand very young women, inspired by an unrecorded rock and roll band with see-through blouses and white stripes in their hair, that life is to be lived right now.
You are gonna be really good. Can't explain it.
Things that I've always wanted to say, and I haven't been able to.
We're the Staines, and we don't put out.
I am super excited about this. This is one of those movies that has such an amazing history. It is one of those movies that we designed this podcast for.
True.
Like, when we conceived the idea of doing this podcast, we wanted to take this deep dive into movies that are just so good and so sadly neglected because they have such a niche that they belong in, but at the same time somehow fell through the cracks of history, or, you know, just wasn't right for the time or whatever it was, but people need in their lives, that need to be part of people's story. And this is one such movie. This movie is crazy how much pedigree it has.
True.
We're going to talk about this, and it's going to be like, wait, how have I never seen this? Which many of you will think, you know. And the reason many of you haven't seen this is this. The movie was made in 1982. It was made in like 1981 and released in 82. but it tested very, very poorly. The studio had no faith in it. As we will get into, it is probably one of the most deeply cynical films you have ever seen. And it tested so poorly that they decided to open it up on unlimited release. They opened it on a single screen in Denver, Colorado. It did really poorly, and they scrapped it. And it sat on a shelf for 2 years until something you guys have heard me talk about many times, Night Flight came along. For those of you that aren't familiar with the history of Night Flight was a show that ran for 7 years on the USA Network. When USA Network first came on, they were one of the first cable channels, and they were just running reruns of stuff, and they needed content. And this guy came along and said, I have this great idea. It's for a show. It will run from 10 o'clock at night to 2 a.m. It'll be a 4-hour block of stuff. And then you can repeat it if you want. And and they were like, well, what's it going to be? He's like, well, nobody's showing music videos on television. So we're going to have an hour where we show music videos and do a countdown of music videos. And then we'll talk about something cool in the pop culture, like music or animation or movies. And then we'll show a movie. And we'll show some kind of cult or music film. Essentially, we're going to gear this towards the rock and roll, the punk rock people who are late night folks across America and just have nothing to do on a Friday or Saturday night in the middle of the night. We're going to give them something to drink a beer to, smoke a joint to, and chill the fuck out. And USA Network said, go for it. And Night Flight was born. Night Flight came on 3 months before MTV came online. So they were the first people on television to show music videos.
They're the HD DVD to MTV's Blu-ray.
Yes, exactly. That's a great way to put it. And so they were always looking for feature films to show. And one of the things that you guys may have heard me talk about in the past is because Night of the Living Dead had no copyright because it had gotten fucked up, they could show Night of the Living Dead whenever they wanted to. So every few months they showed Night of the Living Dead. That's how I grew up watching Night of the Living Dead, was on Night Flight late at night after my parents would go to bed and I would sneak downstairs. And one of the other things is in 1984, someone going through the vaults at Paramount found Ladies and Gentlemen, the Fabulous Stains, and said, oh my God, we have to show this. And Paramount's like, if you want to, we showed it on a single screen. Nobody cares about that movie. Gave it to them for a song. And they showed the shit out of it. And people fell in love with it. And so in love with it that they called on Paramount to release it somehow, because the only way people really saw it for the first year of its existence was edited for television. So, like, none of the swears, of which there are many, you know, a couple of the racier bits of this movie, all were cut out of the film on Night Flight. So they put it out in theaters on an art house run in 85, 3 years after it had been released and dumped and then banished. And so in 85, you could see it, you know, in New York and L.A. in a small art house run. And then it vanished again. And the only way you could see it for years was on videotape, where people would have videotapes of the old Night Flight episodes where you could watch this edited version of it. And it took until 2008 before we finally got a DVD release of it. And to this day, there is only one known copy of this film in existence, which tours. The Draft House gets it like once every 2 years, and I go every time they show it. That's how I ended up showing it to my wife and your ex-roommate, who but neither of whom had actually seen it, and it came and we went and saw it on 35. And it is an amazing gem that has had this very rocky ride. That as we lay out what this movie is, you're going to be like, how the fuck is that not a bigger thing?
Now, I want to go back to something you said about when we were talking about the possibility of doing this movie. The entire time we were having that conversation, for all those multiple years across all those multiple seasons of the show and not covering it, is because I actually confused this movie with The Commitments. So every time you said Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains, the movie that I saw in my head that I thought you were referring to was The Commitments.
No.
You've got a lot to learn, you little...
No, obviously I know that's not right now, in hindsight.
I'm not against covering The Commitments at some point. I know a lot of people really love The Commitments. I barely... it's one of those movies that comes up every once in a while. I saw it when it came out. I remember liking it, but I don't remember anything of it.
Well, see, and the problem was I had never seen either movie, so I only had titles and posters really to go on.
No, this movie is weird. It is directed by Lou Adler, who was a music business exec, did a lot of, like, he produced Rocky Horror Picture Show, and, you know,
he's mostly known as a producer. He only had one other directorial credit under his belt, which is actually pretty impressive. It was Cheech and Chong's Up in Smoke.
Yes.
So, I mean, he is a kind of a two-hit wonder, but then he never directed anything else.
No, because this was a huge bomb for him. Like, this was, he sunk a lot into this. This was a very hard production. It ended up tanking, and while it lives on in cult, with real true cult status, it never achieved anything, and it torpedoed his career.
However, is possibly one of the greatest film discoveries for me of the entirety of the time we've been doing this show. Like, this is one of the rare situations where I watched the movie for the show, it was over, and I immediately watched it again. I was so excited to get to see this movie and then to get to watch it again, because it's exactly the type of movie that I hope to run across just when I'm searching randomly for things. So this was such a win for me. I'm so excited that that's how we're kicking off this month.
It is a legitimately great rock movie. And what astounds me about it, every time I watch it, I mean, I love this movie, but every time I watch it, after I'm done watching it, I always forget just how fucking deeply cynical a movie it is.
It is so
fucking cynical about the rock and roll lifestyle, that almost every moment of this movie is cynical about it. They never, ever, ever sell the glory that is being a rock star in this movie. There is never a moment where you, like, feel elated for these characters as they are triumphing. You know, you see a lot of these, you know, there's a movie I love that I really want to cover at some point called Rockstar.
The Wahlberg movie?
Yeah. I love Rockstar.
Hey, bro. Hey, I'm a rock star. Did you see that movie?
That movie's great.
It's basically me doing karaoke, bro, but I'm really good at it.
You know, that movie is legitimately wonderful, and we will talk about it at some point. But that movie fits that typical arc where it's the rise and then fall of a character. This is not that. It might kind of seem like that, but this is really a movie about people in real shit, a real shit place in their life, who kind of throws everything away to go join the circus. And boy, howdy, is it a fucking circus.
And not only that, but one of the things that really grabbed me about this movie is its oddball story structure, in that if this were a typical rise and fall story, the part where the fall, like the turning point of this movie, would still have 45 minutes to an hour left. This had 7 minutes left when that moment hit. I was so shocked that at the height of our girl band, when things start to turn on them and their success is pointing downward, the movie's almost over. And in fact, originally was just going to end there.
Yes. And we'll get to that, because that is very important about this movie. The fact is, this movie has a happy ending that is even more cynical than the cynical ending. Like, this is amazing. So let's get into this. So what's really, this movie kicks off and our protagonist is already a celebrity. Like, that's what's weird.
Yeah.
Before we get into that, one of the most interesting things about this film is its cast. So I'm going to ask you one question right up front, because this is the most important question of this movie. How fucking sexy is young, sexy Ray Winstone?
So sexy that I will admit to you that you told me he was in this movie.
Yeah.
I knew to look for him in this movie. I watched the entire movie once and went, where the fuck was Ray Winstone in that movie? And then when I watched it again, I'm like, oh my God, he's the front man of the other punk band. That's Ray Winstone?
Young, sexy lead Ray Winstone. This is the thing, is I am like, here we go. Old man Cargill.
That old man Cargill.
I mean, I have had Ray Winstone as a major part of my cinema life for my whole life, and I had never seen, until I saw this movie, young, sexy Ray Winstone. Like, who the fuck is that guy?
Yeah.
It is astonishing. Like, this is the experience that everyone's had, because I have told them, oh my God, young, sexy Ray Winstone, and everyone's like, okay. And they sit and they watch it, and they're like, they're watching the scene where he first comes out on stage and goes, oh my God, it's Ray Winstone.
Yeah.
And you just flip and you cannot believe it because you've never seen him in this good of shape. You've never seen this kind of charisma exude off him.
Yeah.
Like, this is like when we talked about a movie last year, The Final Terror, where you see Joe Pantoliano unhinged in a way that you're surprised over the rest of his career you never saw. This is that Ray Winstone where you're like, where has this guy been in every other performance? Like, he's an amazing actor.
He's dashing. He is baby-faced. And even at this point in his career, I feel, because he's so scary, just seconds away from murder, he is going to kill everybody.
There's a scene in this movie where he gets out of a car the day after a show, and he leans over and makes out with the driver a bit, and he gets out, and there's a girl who's been on his lap, and then he makes out with her a bit. And you're like, oh, that dude just took two girls from the show home. Of course he did.
Yeah.
Like, of course he did. Like, it's not like there's, it's like, yes, of course that guy fucking got two different girls from the show to go home and have a threesome, because that's the kind of lead singer he is. Like, the amount of charisma that this guy has in this role makes me wonder why he didn't hit as an actor in that age range in the 80s. Why did we have to wait till the 90s for him to start appearing in shows when he was older and had put on 30-40 pounds?
If we had known then what we know now, the movie might have been called Ladies and Gentlemen, the Sexy Ray Winstone.
It really, like, because that's the thing, is the rest of this cast, oh my God, fucking amazing.
I know, it's like Ray Winstone is amazing in this, but he is not even, the actual band itself, the Staines, is made up of Not only exceedingly young Diane Lane.
Oh, God, yes. In one of her first roles. Not her first, but really fucking young.
And then, of course, on bass guitar, Laura Dern.
Dude, who's not given a whole hell of a lot to do in this movie, but is fucking great.
She has that really great moment early on where she's arguing with her mother over her own name, where she's like, I hate the name Jessica. It makes me want to throw up. And her mom's like, well, that's the name I gave you. And she's like, well, that's why it's lousy. And it's just like, this is the epitome of punk music at this time, was causeless anger.
Well, yeah. Well, they don't lean too heavily on it. The first 5 minutes of this movie is about it. And then they kind of move on. And we're not even reminded of it until a short little bit towards the end of the movie. But these girls are pure white trash.
Yeah.
Their mothers are drunks who, from what we're given, is that they were probably single mothers. Like, they don't seem to, that, like, there's never been fathers in their life. And there certainly aren't fathers that are even mentioned in this movie. They are just white trash who have nothing else going on. Two of the girls are just, they're teenage girls. Their mothers died. They've got nothing. And so they literally just grab their shit and go to become punk band, even though they've only practiced three times.
So we should run down the plot of this movie, because this is a film that falls into the category of, I'm almost positive 80% of the people listening to this episode have not seen, because of the veracity of when we talk about a movie slipping through the cracks, like, it is verifiable with The Fabulous Staines. This is a movie that wasn't available on DVD for 26 years after its release. This is a movie that only didn't get a wide theatrical release when it was released.
Yeah.
This movie that sat on the shelf for 2 years. There's so much about this movie that when we say fell through the cracks, unseen, it's not hyperbole. It is entirely true. So let's break down the plot here a little bit. This movie starts, and one of my favorite things about this movie is this faux documentary framing device.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's what it is it's actually the old style of 60 Minutes.
Yeah.
So it's a 60 Minutes episode, and and we are introduced to
Corinne Burns,
yeah,
or as she likes to call herself, Third Degree Burns, and it starts with, as Cargill said,
who is the aunt of Acid Burn from Hackers.
Yes, it's true. As it turns, there's a whole cinematic universe going on here that you guys aren't even aware of. I'm telling you, if Hackers 2 had gotten made, the villain would have been Ray Winstone. That's a verifiable fact as well. So
don't look it up, but it's
verifiable. Look it up. Do not look it up. Don't you fucking go to IMDb. Don't you look it up. So we're introduced to her, as Cargill said, already famous, because the beginning of the movie is a follow-up to a segment we never saw about life in this small town, and she plays a fry cook at a restaurant who gets fired on the air, and the beginning of the movie is following up with her. What's she up to now? And this is where we learn a lot about Corinne. We learn that her father died in the army, and she is starting to rebel against a lot of things. She doesn't get along. Her mom actually had just died as well. So she doesn't get along with her aunt. So her and her sister who in the band is known as Depleted, and their band is called The Stains, and they've decided to, like Cargill said, pack up and kind of join the circus. And just this is the great thing about this movie in terms of feminism, is the amount of ownership that Diane Lane's character has to just say, I'm going to go do this thing because I'm fucking sick of where I am right now. I don't know anything about this world. I'm not even sure I know how to play an instrument or write songs. Because they don't. But she's like, fuck it, I'm going to do it anyway, and I'm not taking no for an answer. And that's really the difference between this and a lot of Runaway movies, is that she's a runaway, but she's not directionless. She knows exactly where she wants to be, and she's going to just go out and do it.
Yeah, and she just fucking does it. And the thing is that because she is a pseudo-celebrity, and because she is such an interesting train wreck, she gets picked up by this guy who's the smallest of small-time music guys. He's literally, he owns a bus, and he is a tour bus guy, and he goes around and does tours and picks these girls up as an opening act for a terrible tour. A tour that is just rock bottom. It is, and here's the what's so magical about it. All three bands that are on this tour are at very different stages of their career, and it's showing the shittiness of every stage. You have them who literally haven't played a show when they get picked up. He has no idea how bad they are.
And I forgot to mention, Laura Dern is their cousin, who is also in the band. So that's the trio.
Yes. So they're at the very beginning of their career. They're playing their first gigs. They don't have a single follower. But we see them get their first fan, and we follow. You can actually track that fan through the course of the movie as well, who's given like three lines in the whole movie, but is an important integral part of understanding the film. Then you've got the Looters, and the Looters are this up and coming punk band. They've done some shit. This is their first American tour. They're really excited because they're finally expanding, you know, to another continent. But they didn't really know what that meant. And then you have the Metal Corpses.
Oh, boy, the Metal Corpses.
The Metal Corpses, who had one hit song on the radio 7 years ago and are now still touring, still trying to make it happen again. But can't. They're well past. They have one hit, and they pretend every time they play that they haven't been playing this song every fucking gig.
Dude, the brutality in the way that this is shot is like, you want to talk about a takedown. The shot where they're about to play this song and they're like, we haven't played it for a couple years, didn't want to rest on our laurels. Which is so, oh my God.
It's,
like,
it's beautiful. And
the one single girl in the audience who's like, yay, roadmap of my tears. And the rest of the place is silent. Like, to me, that's the most brutal takedown of this band, is there's one person room.
Who has been that, by the way. Who has been that girl that he sleeps with every time he comes to this town?
Yeah,
she's like their one fan in town. It is, yeah. This movie harshly shines. Like, there is no one in this movie who is at the height of their powers or has hit it big. These are all people on the outs at their own part of their career. And so essentially, the Metal Corpses and the Looters fucking hate each other.
Oh my God, Ray Winstone standing off stage like, you old farts, fuck you, get off the stage. It's so beautiful.
So the Metal Corpses demand that this bus driver gets another band to replace the Looters. And so that's why he picks up the Stains, because he needs someone by morning. Get the Stains. He gets the Stains. And so they go on the tour together. But shortly after it starts, the lead bassist and one of the key writers of the music of the Metal Corpses ODs.
Yeah.
And So they have to drop out, and it becomes the Looters and the Fabulous Stains. But what happens as the Fabulous Stains, despite their lack of musical acumen, their message connects in the early 80s tri-state area where women are just being treated, you know, like shit. All of a sudden, these powerful feminist women are developing an audience of women who are showing up and dressing like them and acting like them and are super excited that someone's finally speaking for them. And it's watching as this small band eclipses this other small band, and watching how each of those bands play each other,
yeah,
to try to angle their own careers.
Yeah.
And nobody in this movie has a genuine, heartfelt, angle on this. Nobody is good and pure in this film. Everybody is out for themselves. And this movie is Lou Adler shining a light at all the bullshit in the music industry of the 70s and early 80s.
Now, we mentioned the fact that Lou Adler never directed again after this. This was the movie, unfortunately, that kind of ended his career and was a flop. But I have got to give him props for taking a chance on something that he obviously felt very personal about, because the other project they offered him that he could have done instead of this over at Paramount was a little movie called Airplane. And he turned it down so that he could make Ladies and Gentlemen, the Fabulous Stains.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
To put your heart and soul into a project that takes place in a world that you know and is a passion project to that degree, gotta tip my hat to him, because holy crap, Airplane. In terms of cultural staying power, you have Airplane and you have Ladies and Gentlemen, the Fabulous Stains.
Yeah, well, but... dude, have Lou Adler's Airplane would not be
true. This Airplane is also true. This is also
like
true.
Airplane is Airplane because of Abrams the geniuses behind it.
Yeah, no, this is very true. But one of the things I really dig about the way that they go about getting what they want in terms of the Stains is they establish their look, and their look, or at least her look, is this sort of weird skunk streaked hair, and then she's wearing like an old lady blouse that's very sheer, and she's wearing nothing underneath it, and then she's wearing like underwear and fishnets, and really just getting in the faces of the audience and daring them to not like her. And there's a great scene after their first performance that completely bombs, where she unveils this look that apparently the other two members of the Stains had no idea she was going to do based on their reaction. And Laura Dern says to her, you know, why did you do that? We want people to like us. And Diane Lane just says, no, I tell the truth. Like, it never occurs to her to put on any kind of an act or be fake or present something that is going to be marketable. She just wants to get up there and tell people how she's feeling, which is really the essence of punk music to begin with. Is
exactly.
It's about the message, which is why I think so many people really hate punk music, because yeah, some of those songs are downright atonal in terms of the way the guitars are played, the beats, the melodies. They don't give a shit. They don't give a shit whether you can tap your foot to it. All they care about is getting out what they want to say, and that's exactly what this movie is.
This movie is punk rock as fuck.
Punk as fuck.
In fact, I put it up there with Penelope Spheeris's Suburbia in terms of greatest punk rock movies of the 80s.
Yeah, no, I would have to agree with you 100%, and I really dig on the fact that throughout this movie, she is so determined and she has so much agency, even though it's a world she's never been in before. She refuses to, I mean, look at the mantra, look at the battle cry of the Stains, which is "We don't put out."
Yeah.
Which I think is such an interesting commentary on, you know, the taking down the idea that a woman's only currency in the entertainment industry is her body and her ability to please men. Like, from the get-go, this young girl's like, no, fuck that, we're not doing it.
Well, except that, no, I mean, that's what I find the beauty of what the Stains are doing, is she puts her sexuality out there and then says, this is mine, it's not yours. We don't put out. We're not your toys. And she's putting her sexuality in everyone's faces and then saying, you don't get this. And it's such an interesting message, and it's so delightfully confused that it nails like her youth, but also really does have this great kind of distillation of feminism, of the of second wave feminism of the 60s and 70s. It's really fascinating in how she puts that out there. But at the same time, people, you know, like mainstream are rejecting it. Like mm-hmm. there's one of my favorite characters in this movie is the guy with the most punchable face in the world.
Oh, that fucking guy.
This newscaster.
Oh, I hated him.
No, like every word that comes out of his mouth, he's one of those local newscasters who talks in such a way. Like he seems to be like he has borrowed the affectation of Andy Rooney.
What it really amounts to is some girl dropouts who are using the media.
That's who he is. He's fucking Andy Rooney. And
First of all, if Junk Food Cinema had its own punk band, the Dead Roonies would be a really good name for that band.
That might be a good name for a punk band.
I'm just throwing it out there. If it's to call me crazy, but when I listen to music, I want it to sound like
not
music.
The Dead Paulins.
Call me crazy.
So, yeah, but so this guy just, he is not having any of this feminism bullshit. Like, he is just, every word that comes out of his smarmy mouth is like mocking these girls and these women with their ideas and their pantsuits. And he's juxtaposed against this young feminist co-anchor who is really fascinated by what's happening and the movement springing up. And it's really great because as you track the week-long progression of the Stains rise and fall, because it really is this short amount of time, there's this great moment where the anchor comes on and is like, well, actually, the segment was originally going to be done by the woman, but she's been moved up to the network.
Yeah.
So we all wish her the best of luck. Like, you see that her coverage of the Stains has actually gotten her noticed at the network and they've yanked her, and he's still stuck as this regional asshole.
He is the manifestation in human form of every male rights activist on Twitter.
Yes.
Like, he is the living, breathing embodiment of all those shitty tweets you see.
All he needs is a neck beard and a fedora and a vape pen, and he's ready to go. Like, he's like, every word that comes out of his mouth is carefully crafted from an IQ 98 read of a dictionary.
Yeah. By the way, the Vape Pens is not a good name for a band. Don't ever use
don't
that.
Don't ever be the Vape Pens.
I wouldn't even let the Vape Pens open for
the
Dead
Roonies.
But
they can play indoors most places. I mean, that's kind of the point of the vape pens. So,
look, hey, let's not talk about... Do you want to be a professional? Let's not talk about vaping anymore. Do you want to be a professional?
Sidebar, how great is the song, Do You, The Professionals?
Most of the songs in this are really good. That one especially, though.
Yes,
absolutely.
Who knows what you're gonna see?
Not me, not me, not me.
Who knows when your turn will be?
Not me, not me.
Join the professionals.
It's another interesting thing about this movie is the tracking of the song "The Professionals."
Yeah,
where
which is its own character.
You first hear it by the Looters, and it's fucking great. And then you hear the terrible cover by the Stains, and then you hear a decent cover by the Stains later, and then the movie, with its ending, we hear it again in its most polished, amazing form, and we will get there. But yeah, so we're following them through this television coverage of them that's covering the movement of them. Like, we see the rock and roll of it, and then everything in the television is all about the feminist angle of this film, which is very deeply, profoundly feminist. Like, there's no question about the agenda of this movie at all. And it does a really good job of showing the various angles of it, right down to the whole "she doesn't put out," where ultimately this whole movie she's had this kind of weird love thing with Ray Winstone. And finally the culmination of that, and just kind of the raw animalistic passion of like that.
But I even love in that scene where they finally do get together, where like the build up to them sleeping together, she'll like get up and walk into the other room when he's mid-sentence. Like, there, like, yes, she has decided to sleep with him, but at no point is the ball in his court in that love scene.
She doesn't respect him.
She doesn't give a shit.
She doesn't. She doesn't respect him at all. And in fact, she ends up using him and stealing from him and then fucking him.
Yeah.
And not giving into his wiles, but getting him to give into hers. And it's really amazing how they go about it.
No, it's absolutely incredible. And I was just, as we were talking, I realized we keep saying we'll get there through this episode. And I'm like, and now playing their chart-topping hit, here's the Dead Rooneys with We'll Get There, which is the running theme of this episode.
Well, yeah, well, so let's get to that.
Let's get to there.
The end of this movie, again, this movie is so, so fucking cynical. Like, nobody is getting what they think they're owed. Everybody is shitty. One of the things I noticed on this particular viewing of it, I don't know that there's a scene where somebody isn't fucking smoking and isn't putting out a cigarette on the floor of the bus to then immediately light up another cigarette. Like, this movie is like, I'm surprised. I would not be surprised if we found out that the film stock wasn't tar stained. Like,
right.
There are cigarettes fucking everywhere.
I did think it
movie.
Was odd that the cinematographer was credited as somebody named Philip Morris. Yeah. So,
but it is like, it is just, it's everywhere. And these, we finally get to the end and they have stolen the big song of the Looters, mm-hmm. and they are playing that, and they feel so ripped off by that, that they go out to play a show, and it's a shit show. Like, they're playing a cultural center in the middle of nowhere.
It's a practically, fucking mall.
It's a mall.
It's a fucking, like, Tiffany should be the next to go on, because it's a goddamn mall.
And they're like, well, let's fucking do it. And they walk in, and the place is packed with girls dressed exactly like the Staines. And they're booing and hissing the Looters, who are now opening for the Staines.
Yeah.
Because the Staines are the big act here. And they're, and he just, Ray Winstone loses his shit and calls all these girls out on just how fake Corinne is.
And I think if there is, there are actually several common threads between the movie we're covering this week and the movie we're covering next week.
Oh, absolutely.
The biggest of which being that both of the movies deal with one very cynically, the other cynic with a tongue in its cheek about the nature of fads and the
fact that both fads take place over the course of a week.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really just about how flaky, you know, the consuming public is and how quickly that they can turn on the thing that they love.
By the way, what we're talking about next week is Josie and the Pussycats. And if you get a chance, watch both these films together, because they are two great tastes that taste great together that are about very, very, very similar content in very different ways.
Can you repeat what movie we're doing next week?
Josie and the Pussycats.
I wanted you to do that for the people who are like, he did not just fucking say Josie and the Pussycats. Did it?
They've heard me talk about this several, like, the longtime junkies heard me read you the Riot Act years ago when we did our teen month, and I mentioned Josie and the Pussycats, and you were like, yeah, no, you made fun of it, and I called you out on that and said, we're going to do that. I'm going to make you watch that someday.
No, it's cool. It's very warm under this bus. Thanks, Cargill.
Yeah. I will gladly throw you under the tour bus.
Be a professional. Yeah. You're not being a professional. No,
don't kick the bus. You know, that's another thing we haven't talked about yet. The musicians in this movie are actual big musicians. That was one of the big selling points. It's why Night Flight picked it up to begin with, because it wasn't, hey, here's that movie with a bunch of young actors who will 30 years from now be huge, because they had no idea. They're like, can we get that movie that where the Clash plays the backup band? Can we get that movie where we get a famous reggae musician to play the bus driver?
Right.
Like, everyone playing music in this band was somebody who was on the scene at the time. So, like, these characters hanging out on the bus feel so authentic because they've been on that fucking bus for 10 years.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
It's crazy how authentic this movie is.
So, quick sidebar.
Oh, it's not the Clash. There's someone from the Clash in the movie, and the backup band is the Sex Pistols.
Ah, there you go.
That's what it is.
So the person that, as we're talking about all these people who would be famous later that are in this movie, the one person that I think will probably never get mentioned is who plays the boss, Corinne's boss, in that brief segment at the very beginning of the movie. It's fucking Brett Spiner.
Yeah.
Fucking Data is in this
movie.
He's
barely, you see him from the back shoulder.
Yeah.
Like, Brent Spiner's in this film for like literally a second and a half.
But that back shoulder, surprisingly human.
Very, very, very human. Deeply human.
He must have had his chip in that day.
So we get to we're at the cultural center. Ray Winstone has read the riot act. And then all of a sudden, you know, they walk off stage. Corinne and the Staines come on. But the girls have heard his message and they fucking hate the Staines and they see through the dressing and the pomp and circumstance and see how they're all being fleeced for money.
But that's the thing that really is just like the tragedy of this movie is it's not even fucking true. Because what Ray Winstone tells them is like, all of this money you're spending on your clothes to look just like them, it's just going in their pocket. They're making money off of you. And then she, after this, has to put a knife to their fucking manager's throat to get the money that they're owed.
Oh, yeah.
They're not getting rich off of this at all.
But that's what I love about the cynicism about this movie is it takes the audience's cynicism about rock stars and turns that on its head as well. Like, they all reject this. But yeah, she goes to get the money and he doesn't want to pay her. So yeah, she has to hold the can opener or a fucking throat and threaten to slit his throat just to get the money they're owed, which she then, in her one true altruistic act, then gives to the bus driver because he's currently trying to save up money to pay bail to get one of his buddies out of jail. And so she gives him the money, who she screwed him over, and this is her redemption for that. And then we get to the final bit of the movie, the happy ending.
Now, this is the part I have to say, when I watched it the first time, was a little jarring to me because the movie seemed to go out of its way, especially with immediately after that concert where someone literally like throws shit on her face and
yeah, throws hair dye at her
hair and they're like booing and it seems like their career is over. She's immediately back in that studio doing an interview with Punchface McDickbag and he's, you know, condescending to her and
doesn't even let her speak.
Dude,
she's just there so he can mansplain to her.
Which I would know nothing about being on the show. But the thing that really bothers me about that interview is he's...
Actually.
I hope Cargill's band can open for the Dead Roonies. His band, Well Actually. It's going to be huge. No, the part where he says something about them making money off of these girls. And she tries to say, we didn't make any money. And he goes, well, whatever the case. I hate that shit. I hate it when someone's wrong and they just say, well, whatever, as if it's inconsequential. I'm like, no, it was the exact fucking point you were making and you were goddamn wrong.
For example, I'm going to go back and correct you because that is not the name of my band. It's not, well, actually, it's the name of my band is What You Need to Understand Is.
That's true. That is entirely horrifyingly true. And it just came screaming back to me.
yeah. He is. God, you just want to beat the shit out of this fucking.
I hate him
anger.
So much.
He's the worst guy in the movie. Like, of all the shitty people, of like the drug using fucking laurels resting rock stars in this fucking movie, the worst guy in the movie is a fucking local news anchor who you just want to knock the mustache off his upper lip.
I have more respect for the guy with five illegitimate kids who died of a cocaine overdose in this movie, which, by the way, is one of the sillier parts of this movie, is that the 60 Minutes feature they're doing has some real graphic death photographs that I don't think they would actually allow on TV. They're like literally showing him dead on the toilet, and then as they're taking his body out, like his shoes under the coroner's sheet. I'm like, you know, I don't see too much of that on the news anymore. But the thing that was jarring about the ending is they go to such great lengths to establish the fact, especially with that interview, that things are fucking over for the Staines. And they're making a point about fads and trends. And Ray Winstone even has to come and apologize to her because he realized how much he's fucked them. And then pretty much as they get on the bus, the next thing you see is a group of girls sitting around in the parking lot, all dressed like she is. And it's clear that the Staines are still a movement.
Listening to their song.
And it's just, and that's how the movie builds to its ending, where we see them performing on sort of an MTV.
It is MTV. It's actually making fun of MTV.
Which has just come out. This is the crazy thing about this movie is when they were making it, MTV didn't exist. When they first started making this movie, there was no MTV. It came out during the course of this movie getting released. So there is a little bit of a weird sort of prescience to this film where they're kind of predicting the rise of, and she even says in the movie at the very beginning that her goal is that she says, I'm going to buy a radio station and it's going to have no news and no commercials and we're just going to play music all day long. And I'm like, she's describing MTV, but on the radio.
Yeah. Well, and here's what's also kind of awesome. This is one of those things where it works out really well, because the studio was so unhappy with Lou Adler's original ending, they demanded a happier ending where the Staines actually hit. And so he creates what is ultimately a super cynical ending that they had to shoot a year later. So it takes not only takes place a year later, but these girls who are girls at the time hit puberty and aged an entire year in that year and look significantly older in the very end of this film. So yeah. These girls who are teenage girls when they shoot this all of a sudden are women on an MTV music video, but they have lost all of their feminist edge and are now essentially Bananarama or the Bengals,
yeah,
where it's all big hair and they're performing and they're dressing up in costumes and doing the whole music video thing. And they've sold out. And the happy ending of this week, the happy fucking ending, is that the feminist Staines have sold out and have made it big.
Good night, America. Hope you feel good about yourself.
Dear God, that's Lou Adler's happy ending to the movie. It's fucking insane.
Yeah.
How cynical this goddamn movie is.
It was so long after production and wrap that they had to pull Diane Lane off of the Streets of Fire set.
Yes.
To, like, get her. I may have made that up, but it was.
No. No, it wasn't Streets of Fire, but it was like she was. It may have been Streets of Fire because it was something like it was right there up against it when they shot it, because it was a year after, because they had already tested it and it did not test well. And they're like, you need to shoot something. So they just shot a music video. They didn't shoot any additional footage of the movie. They literally just shot a music video, which shows us that, hey, they hit it big. And so it's just them doing a music video where they look so radically different. And I love that about this, that we do catch up with them later in their career. And The Professionals is now a hit that you'd hear on whatever your local Bob station is.
So I want to propose a cinematic universe much in the same way you did during Lionheart.
Let's do it.
In that, so we have the Staines and they have a rise and fall, but then of course the big cynical victory for them is that they sell out and the Staines become huge and Corinne Burns or Third Degree Burns, they ride that success for a while, but then that turmoil, that inner conflict tears the band apart, and she does go solo, and she realizes that because she had built herself up as such a rebel and a nonconformist, and now that image is tainted by the fact that they sold out. She can't even call herself Third Degree Burns or Corinne Burns anymore, so she changes her name to Ellen Aim, and she starts a solo career. But wouldn't you know it, during one of her big concerts, she gets kidnapped by Willem Dafoe, and it's up to Michael Paré to save her.
Small body, but bobblehead Willem Dafoe, by
bobblehead
the way.
Willem Dafoe. He does look like a fuck. He looks like his own Funko Pop in that movie.
He does. He did, you know, shortly after he'd grow into that fucking head of his, but not in Streets of Fire.
Hey, if there's one actor you should have toys of, it's Willem Dafoe. Put me on your toy shelf.
Nope, not going to do it, Willem. Not going to do it. That sounds terrifying to me. Actually, one of the things that's really interesting about watching this movie now and discovering this movie now is as you dig into the history of what was going on behind the scenes, it's kind of depressingly poignant to watch this movie now, because if you watch the credits, you may notice that the writer on this movie is credited as Rob Morton. That's actually an alias that was adopted by writer Nancy
Dowd.
Nancy Dowd changed her name in the credits to Rob Morton.
Something, by the way, something she did a lot.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Nancy Dowd is... she's a great screenwriter. She's a famous screenwriter. She won the, she's noted as best known for having won the Academy Award for Coming Home. Fuck that. Not on this podcast. She wrote fucking Slapshot. She is an accomplished screenwriter who wrote on a number of films, did a bunch of uncredited rewrites. And then whenever she was unhappy with how a movie came out, she would remove her name and she'd change her name. And so the tail end of her professional career is pretty much her changing her name on movies because they didn't work out the way she wanted them to.
Yes, and Charleston, Pennsylvania is also the setting of Slapshot, so that links these two movies as well. Now, I don't know, we can't substantiate this, obviously, but as I was doing my research, one of the things I found out is that she departed this project very early, and one of the reasons that was given was that she was supposedly or allegedly groped by a camera operator on this set.
Oh, fuck that.
And when you think about what this movie is and the feminism that it represents and the, you know, we don't put out and the taking agency over your sexuality and not allowing it to become your only form of currency, And to have the female writer of a movie like that potentially leave a film entirely because of that kind of action, and then you look at everything that's going on today in the industry.
Oh, yeah.
You well, need to fucking watch this movie and think about these
well,
things.
Well, and just from a political stance in the industry, someone above the line leaving a production because they were harassed by someone below the line is really absurd. And when you think about where women were in the industry in the early 80s, that kind of nails it right there.
Yeah.
You can replace a camera operator at the drop of a hat. Like, good camera operators are good fucking camera operators. I'm not going to diss on camera operators at all. Quite the contrary. But
if the choice is replace a camera operator or replace a screenwriter,
that's a huge, huge issue. You can, you know, you're going to change the entire voice of your production having a different screenwriter around. When you need to make changes, like on a low budget production like this, you're going to have to call audibles and have the writer come in and work around whatever crazy shit is getting in your way.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's, I had not heard that story. That story is horrifying.
It really is. And again, it just makes it so much more appropriate to watch this movie now and think about these themes. And I want to point out that as cynical as this movie is, it does have two moments that I thought were so genuine and so heartbreaking that I was actually very moved by it. And it added to my experience of watching it. One, of course, being, as we talked about, Lawn Boy, the bus driver, trying to raise money so that he can free a fellow Rastafarian musician who is locked up in Jamaica because of weed. And so that was very moving. And then, well, moving in the sense that that's where she ends up giving all the money. But there's a moment that I feel like is the opposite of everything you see in I, Tonya, where they actually interview...
They
interview her aunt, and she's talking.
They interview Laura Dern's mother.
Laura Dern's
mother.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, the first 5 minutes of this movie is almost as awful as the newscaster. Yeah. Like, everything she's doing, she is doing to... She's acting like a pompous little teenage girl who is now a mother, so she's in charge, and she's awful.
She treats these girls, and especially her daughter, like they're nothing.
Yeah, like Corinne is on the phone, using the phone in her house because they don't have a phone.
Trying to get a job.
She's applying to a job, and this woman is just talking loud and is annoyed that she's even using the phone, and they're pouring whiskey and being obnoxious, and it's like, fuck this woman. And then towards the end of the movie, we see her on TV and
she basically says, like, this is something I've never told my daughter before, and I'm seeing all the success she's having, and, you know, I'm really proud of her, and she can be.
We were told we were nothing.
Yeah.
And my parents told me I would be nothing, and I became nothing. So that's what I told my daughter. And when I see her go out and do this and not listen to me, I'm so happy she didn't listen to me, and I'm so proud. And I just wish my sister were still alive to see her daughters defying that as well.
Yeah.
Dear God, that moment.
Not a dry eye in the house. Like, it is, and it's so well sold by that actress. It is. Yeah, it's the moment where I was like, this movie has so much to say. It's got a very, and it, very apropos to punk rock, it's got a very grimy, a very DIY kind of texture to it. Like, it very much is aptly framed by that 60 Minutes documentary-type style.
The whole thing feels documentary-like.
It really does. And I think part of that is because, you look at the title, which is actually based on the Rolling Stones documentary, Ladies and Gentlemen, the Rolling Stones. So I feel like that was entirely intentional. Like, we are going to make people watching this believe that they are watching a documentary. And as such, we're going to really touch upon the truth and the true nature of what it means to be a musician, to be on the road, to have to fight for every inch of respect, and, you know, what the industry really does. And it's just so much about that is perfectly punk. And that's really what this movie is. It is perfectly punk. And perfectly punk, maybe too on the nose a name for a punk band, but I wouldn't not go to their
show.
They'd
be a really great folk band.
That's true. Perfectly punk. No, you know what? That's good. And by the way, we keep joking about this, but we obviously know that the name of our punk band would be Nitro Box, because we're constantly having to put the nitro in the box. And I'll tell you where I have to put the nitro back in the box.
Ray Winstone.
Ray fucking Winstone in this movie.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Dear God, is he great.
So,
like, but that's the thing, is all the, we've talked about the actors that are in it, but all of their performances are amazing. Like, you see the power that Diane Lane is going to bring as an adult, like in this film. You see Ray Winstone giving, acting his fucking ass off. Laura Dern has not come into her own yet, but also isn't given much to do here. And she's great. But, you know, this is still, in fact, this is pre-Grizzly 2 Laura Dern, which many of you will remember from way back in our first season.
I love that we were probably, I'm going to go out on a limb, the only podcast on the internet that has to qualify, this is pre-Grizzly 2.
This is pre-Grizzly 2, which to imagine, you're Laura Dern, and you've been in two movies early in your career, one of which was only released on a single screen, and the next was not released at all. Like, that's Laura Dern's early career. Most people, that would break. But, yeah, of course, both of her parents were actors, so she just kept at it and kept plugging away and would eventually become, like, as she is now, a fucking legend.
And speaking of just absolutely punk in all the best ways, Laura Dern's appearance in this movie is punk because her mother, who is Diane Ladd, refused to give her permission to travel to shoot on location because she thought Laura Dern was too young. So Dern sued her for legal emancipation, won it, and did the movie anyway. So she literally sued for emancipation just to be in this movie.
What's that Thanksgiving got to be like when you go home and it's like, so, how did your little rock movie turn out?
I guarantee you that Diane Ladd refers to every side dish as the fabulous mashed potatoes and the fabulous mac and cheese. Could you please pass the fabulous rolls? That would be great. I bet you she never lets that liver down. But you're right. Being in this movie and then being in Grizzly 2, that'll take the milk right out of your coconut. That should have ended your career.
And yet she's a legend. Like, and yeah, she's the fucking star of the latest Star Wars movie. Not the main character, the fucking star of absolutely the latest Star Wars movie.
She is the star going to war in that movie.
Why are you still hanging around here? Why don't you just go back to wherever it was you came from?
So that brings us to the junk food pairing. And of course, with punk rock, with playing these shows, being on the road, it's got to be an adult beverage. It's got to be a beer.
It's got to be warm beer.
It's got to be warm beer that might get skunky. And that's Red Stripe, ladies and gentlemen.
Red Stripe, which is important for, let's talk about three reasons. One, there's a scene in which, you know, our Rastafarian driver hands a beer to our punk rocker, and he's like, what beer is this? It's a Red Stripe. I don't know if that's actual product placement or not, but I do know that the production company that made this, the LLC they made, was called Red Stripe Inc. So,
oh, wow.
So this may have actually been funded by young Red Stripe. Red Stripe was always a company that, as many of you who have listened to the radio knows, they always have a non-traditional sense of selling their beer. Also, I want to mention this because a Red Stripe is one of the greatest beers I have ever had in my life. And I'm going to tell you a brief little story about one of the greatest beers I ever had in my life.
It's good that we have beer here because we're officially at the sidebar.
Yeah, we're at the sidebar. When I got married back in May of 2002, me and my wife went on our honeymoon to Jamaica. And one of the many things we did is we mountain biked down Mount Zion. And what they do is you put you in a car with a bunch of mountain bikes, you drive up Mount Zion, you take a little pit stop at the elementary school where a certain Rastafarian reggae master went to school, and they have a very large mural.
Lawn boy.
It is the traditional, it is exactly what you think, where you're driving off and a bunch of kids are chasing after you yelling. It's literally that, literally. And we went up to the very top of Mount Zion, and we started biking down. And one of the places you stop at is this tiny little bar, kind of. It's literally just a small shack on the edge of the mountain, overlooking down the rest of the mountain and the sea right below, because Mount Zion is right on the sea. And so we're several thousand feet above sea level, looking down at the ocean, down this mountain. And, you know, as having paid, we get one of our drinks for free. And my wife, I don't even remember what she had, but I grabbed a Red Stripe and sat on the edge of the mountain with the most beautiful girl in the world and looked at the ocean drinking a Red Stripe. And God damn it, if that wasn't the greatest beer I've ever had in my fucking life. So,
and to this day, Cargill says that he would marry that beer all over again.
If
given the chance. Because he's a fucking professional. we got a package.
Are we doing that now?
We're going to do that now. Yeah, because Junk Food Cinema, we don't publish an address because we get things like this, which looks like a ransom note. It's just a box that says open on air. Yeah, so
if this is a severed head, I'm going to be sorely disappointed.
If it's not Gwyneth Paltrow's severed head, I will be severely disappointed. But yes, this is from Meryl Barr, who is a longtime listener and is now the editor of Junk Food Cinema. So I'm just going to dive right into this and hope to God there are no human body parts in here. Okay, so there's a note that says, "In honor of the junk tab, enjoy this post-holiday treat courtesy of 50% off candy season at Walgreens. Sincerely, your friendly neighborhood podcast editor." Oh my goodness, you will actually be pleased to know that it is two packages of Ghirardelli peppermint bark squares. No one died. There's no money that's going to be forced to us to pay to get anyone back. Actually, when I got this package, the first thing I did is run down my list of loved ones to make sure that they were all accounted for and not had been abducted. So thank you very much, Meryl, for the peppermint bark and for not sending us pieces of kidnapped victims. We really appreciate that. And that's going to do it for this episode. I'm so happy that we got to kick off Gals Who Rock with Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains, a movie that is now in my repertoire of, like, when I need to recommend, you know, lesser known movies, when I need to really shell out the gems to people, this is going to be right there.
Now you know why I've been evangelizing about this movie for years.
Because it's not The Commitments.
And like I mentioned earlier, there is only one known print of this movie that is being taken care of by someone and being lent out and taken around the country on road shows. So if you live in a city that does repertory movies and you see that Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains is one of those movies, for the love of God, join the cultural experience. Go see it, because you will watch the only print that almost anyone who's seen it in a theater has seen. You know, I've seen it in a theater twice now. I've watched the same print, and I've watched the same print as all my friends in LA who have seen it on a big screen, and all my friends in New York who have seen it on the big screen. This one print is going around that we are all sharing and sharing this experience together. So if you ever get the chance, join the experience, see this movie in glorious 35mm, and enjoy the fuck out of Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains.
And just be careful that you don't accidentally pick up a copy of Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stained, or instead of a great rock and roll movie, you'll get whiny, whiny rock.